Jack V. James Gray, 96-3363-CR. Ms. Mollison, you are representing Mr. Gray. You may approach the podium and begin.
May it please the court, my name is Helen Mollison, and I represent James Gray, who's the defendant in this case. Mr. Gray was charged with one count of attempting to obtain controlled substance by misrepresentation. He had also originally been charged with two other counts, one of which was retried, the other of which was dismissed outright for insufficient evidence. I would like, unless you have any questions, to immediately get to the main issues that I would like to stress today. I'm asking that my client's conviction be reversed, essentially because the uncharged acts, especially Exhibits 2 and 4 through 7, are irrelevant. I do not believe that they are properly connected to the defendant. It is implicit in the concept of relevance that the defendant has to commit the other acts. I also maintain that these exhibits crucially bolstered the state's case and that there were no cautionary jury instructions given, which further inflames the confusion that existed in this case. I also further will argue that the 1990 conviction is not similar enough to show plan or absence of mistake. That was another uncharged, or that was a charged bad act from his prior history, and that the lack of similarity there also further confused the matters at hand. I'm also going to argue that the general relevance objection that the trial attorney made throughout that trial is enough to preserve the objections that I'm raising today. It's very confusing to follow the facts of this case, although conceptually I don't know that it's so difficult. So I had made a chart and I revised it in my brief in chief for the Supreme Court, and I think it would be handy if people refer to that, or the justices refer to that as needed throughout the comments. I'm not sure if the Assistant Attorney General approves of everything that I've written on the chart. We were talking just before this hearing began about count one. I've written exhibit 9 down on there because it involves a bottle refill.
What page are you referring to in your brief?
Oh, I'm sorry. The chart that I'm referring to is in my brief in chief.
Page seven.
Got it.
Sorry.
Okay.
I had changed count one, which is the remaining count my client was convicted on, to show that exhibit number 9, which is a bottle my client had when he was arrested by the police, which was a refill of the original Sherry Sanders prescription, that is the count that we're dealing with in count one. And originally that had read exhibit 3, which was the original script from the Sherry Sanders prescription. So we're dealing with the difference between the original script and the refill of which was the physical bottle. I do believe that my amendment of Exhibit 9 is more accurate, but the state can make whatever comments that they want to on that one. In any event, Exhibits 2 and 4 through 7 are essentially the Johnson scripts and the Betty Jo Thompson scripts. And they crucially bolstered the state's case. And I also put down on this chart prints that were found from the defendant. The Johnson count 2 had a print on it. Exhibit 3, which was the Sanders original script, had a print on it, and then there also was a print from the prior conviction, which was Exhibit 11. All three of those prints were used to link the client to what the state saw as illegal activity here in trying to get controlled substances by fraud.
Can I just double back and ask you? You said that all this other evidence was just irrelevant. That's your principle? That's your point? Okay.
2 and 4 through 7.
2 and 4 through 7. Okay. So, relevant evidence is evidence that's material. That is, it goes to a issue of consequence, right?
Correct.
And that the evidence makes a fact that it relates to the issue of consequence more or less probative, right?
Yes.
So tell me, what is the issue of consequence to which these items were submitted, in your opinion?
What do I think the state was trying to use them for? I think the state was trying to show a pattern that my client had handled some of these scripts in the past, and that he admitted when he took the stand he ran an ambulance service, and since he had a prior conviction from 1990 that he knew about scripts and about illegal substances, and so they were trying to draw a pattern.
Well, for what purpose? To identify him as the person? Is it to show intent? I mean, you have to have, what's the element in the crime that we're talking about?
I believe that the state was trying to show plan, partly, and also intent. I don't believe the state was successful on that. And I also don't think the state primarily showed that some of these acts were acts of the defendants.
Well, that's why, wasn't that why they were offering evidence of fingerprints to show identity?
The fingerprints were not on, well, two was. Count two had a print on it, but that count, of course, was later dismissed for insufficient evidence. 2 and 4 through 7 don't have any prints. So there was actually no testimony that came in about Betty Jo Thompson. My client didn't say anything about it. There are no prints. There are no witnesses. The pharmacist didn't identify him as picking up or dropping off prescriptions or attempting to obtain drugs. With the Johnson case, Mr. Gray did admit to knowing her and to possibly having handled some of her scripts, but there was no specific connection to him having handled any of it except for that there was the print on count two. But that still doesn't touch exhibits 2 and 4 through 7.
So
that's
so
my
think
point.
That the state was not trying to show the motive of the addiction to drugs?
I'm certain they were.
But I mean, what where did they go wrong with that?
I believe that they went wrong by not showing that these acts were acts of the defendants, and they also didn't even show that all of them were forgeries.
Which ones did they show were forgeries? 4 through 7?
Okay, it's exhibits 1 and 2, the Johnson script. Those were the ones that were, or the count two was thrown out for insufficient evidence. And Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 2 involving Johnson are the ones that I'm talking about. There was a Dr. Kratz who never testified, so forgery was never shown on either of those two exhibits.
Okay, but right now we're only dealing with Count 1, right? That's the only one that's before us?
That's correct.
Now, was Count 1 was a forgery. That was established.
It was proven to be a forgery.
And exhibits 4 through 7 were established to be forgeries.
Yes.
And I guess exhibit 3 too. But with respect to exhibits 4 through 7, was the identity of the forger ever shown?
No, it was not.
And same with exhibit 9. Was the identity of? Did they ever hook up the defendant Gray with the forgery of Exhibit 9?
Well, yes, there are two connections. One, he was there trying to pick up the bottle.
Right.
And second, his print is on the original script.
The print, but what about the forgery?
They proved it was forgery, but not necessarily that Gray wrote it. The document examiner could not determine who had written the scripts.
But did the same person forge Exhibits 4 through 7 and Exhibit 9?
The document examiner said that he believed there was a high probability that the same person wrote the printed portions of all of the scripts he examined, which were, I believe, Exhibits 2 through 8.
Mm-hmm.
But he could not conclude anything about the written signatures. He didn't even make an effort to compare them. He could not include or exclude Gray as the writer of the printed portions of the scripts he examined.
Okay, so what's wrong with this evidence? What's wrong with this evidence? Tick off what you think is...
We don't know that they are acts that the defendant committed, and we don't know that some of them are even forgeries. And yet the state relied on that heavily in its opening statement and closing statement. And that misled the jury. I believe it did.
Counsel, could I ask a question? There were six uncharged subscriptions. Is that right? Prescriptions. But one of them you don't object to.
That is the Sherry Sanders original script. I don't object on the grounds of relevance for that one because of the time frame involved and because his print was on it. I believe that that is relevant and can come in. However, I objected to it on grounds of the statutory objections that there was unfair balancing and also that it doesn't fit the statutory exceptions.
But you are drawing a distinction between Exhibit 3 and Exhibits 2 and 4, 5, 6, and 7.
That is correct.
And yet there's a great deal of similarity between these exhibits, isn't there?
Between what? All of them?
The ones that you really are, the one that you're not really fighting that hard, 3, and the 5 others that you are really objecting to.
Well, I don't see, there are some similarities that you can draw, but I don't think it's sufficient to show that Gray was the one who wrote and or presented the forgeries.
There's
the same substance involved, and the scripts are all passed at a similar time frame.
The handwriting was the same.
Well, there's a high probability it was written by the same person.
And the pharmacy was the same on all except Exhibit 8.
On most of them, they were the F&M pharmacy. I left that off my chart. The Assistant Attorney General had that information on hers.
Well, the only Exhibit 8 was at...
That was the Walgreens incident at Grand Avenue Mall.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Exhibit 3 was proved to be to have the defendant's signature on it.
Fingerprints.
I'm sorry, Exhibit 3 had...
Not signature. What am I saying?
Fingerprints.
Not the signature. Fingerprints on it.
That's correct. Yes. So the client, Mr. Gray, certainly handled it at some point.
And Exhibits 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 were all established to be forgeries.
Yes.
And the substance involved, what is the relationship between hydrocodone and Hicodin syrup?
Well, my understanding is there are two different forms of the same narcotic. One is a syrup or liquid form. The other is dispensed in pill form.
And the time frame is similar.
Yes.
Relatively similar. You have a Dr. Mathias with two different patients, Mays and Thompson. Isn't that correct?
Yes. That's correct.
And the defendant handled Exhibit 8 at some point and had past involvement with the Johnson woman. and Exhibit 2?
I think there was testimony that he handled the Exhibit 8. I know that he admitted that he had probably handled Exhibit 1, which is Count 2. But it doesn't follow necessarily that just because one person may have written the printed portions and that your fingerprint appears on one of the script, on one of the scripts that you issued them all, or presented them, or wrote them, either one. Forgery can include either part.
Counsel, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the prosecutor here and how I would argue that this is admissible. It seems it all starts with Exhibit 3 for me. And the way I would argue it, and then you can answer this, is, well, Exhibit 3 contains the fingerprint of the defendant. And Exhibit 3 is a forgery. And Exhibit 3 is similar to Exhibits 2 and 4 through 7 in the following respects. It is the same forger in all likelihood. They were all cashed at F&M. It was all the same substance, or at least very similar, I can't pronounce that. And the handwriting is the same on all of them. The handwriting on Exhibit 3 is the same, probably the same, as the handwriting on 2 and 4 through 7. And so, Your Honor Mullinson, I move Exhibits 2 and 4 through 7 in because of their similarity to 3, and 3 is definitely connected with the defendant.
And I think you just did it better than the state did it at trial. But the problem...
Take your night job.
Don't give up my day job.
It was much less clear. This is a difficult transcript to read.
Well, how would you answer that? That seems somewhat compelling to me, at least at this point, but it could be full of water.
It bothers me that there is no connection with Betty Jo Thompson. We don't even know if he knows Betty Jo Thompson. Nobody presented any evidence as to who she is, what she is, what his connection with her might have been. And yes, he may have handled the one script that someone else refilled once before he came in and got the bottle on Sherry Sanders. He may have handled it, but it is possible that he didn't know that it was forged. It was, in fact, forged. But there's no reason that the state presented, or no evidence that the state presented, to show that he must have known that. And these four other incidents with Betty Jo Thompson, I think they're too remote in their connection to the defendant. There just wasn't evidence presented about his connection to her or how those scripts might have gotten where they did.
It seems to me that you have two objections here. One is... that I hear, and this is what Justice Babbage was getting at, I think, that you don't have a connection between the defendant in this case and these other examples. So one of your objections is, okay, you got a lot of these forged prescriptions, and they may prove that somebody forged them, and that they knew it was being forged, etc., but they don't tie it up to the defendant. That's the first barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
And I tried to tie them up.
That's right. You tried to tie them up. So you can have 10 rapes, but if you don't show that they're tied up to the rapist under prosecution now, doesn't get you anywhere, even though they may be a pattern of rapes. You don't tie it up to him. That's one thing. Your second objection, if I understand the case, is even if the state can overcome that and show that there is a tie-up here to your client, that it's not relevant to an element in the case, and that therefore, and that then your third one is that even if it's relevant, then you get to the prejudice, then you get to the whether it's character or otherwise, and your fourth one is that even if it's admissible, it's not, it's outweighed by its prejudice. So what I want to get at, now that we have at least an argument about a possibility, that maybe this is tied in, and maybe you don't want to get further, is what is the element? Now, according to the state's brief, I mean, we haven't even talked about waiver, right, which is the main part of the brief. They say that all of this is relevant to knowledge. That his defense was he didn't know the prescriptions were forged, and conversely, to prove that he intended to obtain controlled substances by deception. I'm reading at the top of page 22. Now, are they relevant, assuming that they can prove that your client was somehow involved in these? Is it relevant to those elements? I'm trying to look at the Sullivan test.
I have the warning light on. Am I... Can I still talk?
Yeah, you can talk until it's red.
Okay. Which particular scripts are you talking about? Are you all of them?
You can pick any of them. And maybe that's not the key part of your argument. Maybe the key part of your argument is it's not the defendant that's tied up here, and the rest of it is you don't really want to talk about and rely on your brief.
The relevance objection that I had is based largely on the document examiner's testimony, and it does largely involve 2, 4 through 7. And my objection was that I did not feel the state had shown that these were acts of the defendant, and even further, that some of these acts were forgeries.
Okay.
Now, some of that correction has already occurred.
So you carry on that, because that seems to be your key point. It's not the defendant here.
Yes.
Tying isn't good enough. Okay.
Yes. Okay. I also just wanted to say, with the 1990 conviction, that's a very crucial piece of evidence for the state, because it has the client's fingerprint on it, and it was, I'm sorry, I should have said Mr. Gray. It's Mr. Gray's admission that he was involved in that forgery. Now, we're not clear if that means he wrote it or if he presented it or both, but in any event, he admitted on the stand to his involvement in that. But the 1990 conviction is 4 years old. It's involving Tussund liquid. I do not know what kind of narcotic that is. So if you wanted to admit that, as the state did, to show motive, as they said, to show addiction, I don't know what they're saying he's addicted to in 1990. I think that's a serious problem. It's also not similar enough to show plan or absence of mistake, because it involved a completely different doctor, different signature, different patient name, and different pharmacy. And I submit that those all make it dissimilar enough to be a problem for admission to show plan or absence of mistake. Also, I want to just briefly make a few remarks about waiver, because I did spend a lot of time in the brief responding to the state's position on that. And it's my position that a general relevance objection does preserve the specific ground that I'm objecting to now on appeal, which is lack of connection to the defendant. And I think the state will probably talk more about their position, but as I understood it, their position was that because there was not a contemporaneous objection made at the close of the document examiner's testimony, that this is therefore waived. And there were several general relevance objections made, though, during the course of the trial, and I believe that general relevance and conditional relevance ultimately come down to the same thing. I quoted from commentators in my brief on that point, and they mentioned an article by Professor Ball talking about the difference between conditional relevance and general relevance. It's Mr. Ball's belief there really isn't a difference, and the quotes in the brief that you can read. But I do believe, especially since this trial attorney objected in seriatim at the very end of the trial, he objected to each and every exhibit on grounds of general relevance individually, that he really was attempting to preserve an objection on those grounds, and it should include whether or not the defendant committed the acts.
Well, did the judge ask him to state his reasons or her reasons for the relevance objection, or to expand on it?
No, the judge didn't, and also the judge, when the judge did admit the evidence, the witty evidence, and then the other evidence later that he objected to, the red light just came
on. Okay, you may finish your thought.
The judge did not admit that evidence with any reference to a condition, so that's another reason why I don't think that conditional relevance applies to this case. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bowman. Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I make a lot of waiver arguments since I represent the state, and sometimes I feel like it's almost just a formality, that waiver is something that I just have to get through, and then what's really going to be important is the meat of the case. In this particular case, waiver is not just a formality. The record shows that the defense attorney never articulated at the trial court level the argument that's being made now, which is that there was insufficient evidence to fulfill the condition under which evidence of the five uncharged acts was admitted. 90103 sub 1 of the statutes provides in part, error may not be predicated on a ruling which admits or excludes evidence unless a substantial right of the party is affected and, in case the ruling is one admitting evidence, a timely objection or motion to strike appears of record stating the specific ground of objection if the specific ground was not apparent from the context. The result that we have, what we have here is that there was nothing but the objection to relevance at the trial court level, and it wasn't until the post-conviction motion, which is record item 24, pages 16 to 22, that the present theory is articulated. And the result is that we have an unnecessarily cumbersome appeal. We end up having to assume that defense counsel made certain objections that he in fact stated what is now being argued. That he made that objection in the sidebar conference that appears in referenced at volume 37, page 31. We also end up having to assume that the district attorney, assistant district attorney, made certain promises in response to that objection as to what he thought the evidence was admissible for and what he expected to show later. And we end up also assuming that defense counsel then objected when the later evidence, which the district attorney might have been counting on, didn't deliver, and that a relevance analysis was made then. So we end up with all kinds of mental gyrations. It also means that we're doing one evaluation at the first point where the objection was made, which presumably is where in the sidebar it was said, well, this will be connected up later. And then we have to go to a second point to the objection that didn't happen. And I think judicial efficiency is poorly served because if the defendant is right, the court probably would have struck part of the testimony of the state's document examiner. And if the state is correct, at least we would have had a better record to go on. And when I emphasize assumptions, I am raising the fact that this is presumably going to be a published decision, and yet we have, or published opinion, and yet we have some significant gaps in the record.
Well, of course, the way we can get around that is decide the issue of the relevant of the major issue, and then say, having decided in favor of the state, we need not address their waiver claim.
Well, that would be acceptable. Okay, well, the particular gaps that I'm concerned about, and one of which I didn't even realize until I was preparing for this argument this week, was that we don't really know what the state's rationale was. When Judge Kramer summarized his sidebar later on at volume 37, I think it's page 59, He said it was offered for context, and that would make sense because the objection came at the point when the first pharmacist, Art Hackendall of F&M Pharmacy, was testifying. And the state was basically setting the scene. The pharmacist was working on a Sunday. He noticed a bunch of prescriptions that looked similar and suspicious. He checked on them and so on, and then he turned them over to the police. And then there's later evidence from a police officer that, yes, the pharmacist turned over these seven to him. Beyond context, we don't know what rationale may have been offered.
Well, if you were the trial, the prosecuting attorney, Ms. Bowman, and you had this evidence at your disposal, I guess this is essentially what the chief was asking earlier, how would you argue it to the judge? Why do you think they're admissible?
I think the similarities between the seven prescriptions are compelling. Ultimately,
compelling to what?
Compelling to the issue of intent, to a knowing effort to deceive the pharmacist, that this was not just a mistake. This was not an innocent presentation.
What about identity? They would. That's one of the exceptions too, isn't it?
Yes, and that's one of the ones that was mentioned for the 1990 prescription. I think I would also argue identity simply because there were enough similarities. Let me take that back. As to 2 and 4 through 7, I don't think the similarities in the stories that the defendant gave to, we don't have the evidence of what he told the police officer, so there isn't that. But we do have the similarities of it's all the same substance. It's all, 7 of them are at the same pharmacy, and there's just an 8th pharmacy. 4 of them are for the same patient. 2 of them are presented on the same day for the same patient. It seems to be very much part of a plan, and it has very distinguishing characteristics to it. I thought that perhaps something useful that I could provide to the court after laboring through this record myself, and it's something that I don't necessarily do in my brief, is to just track and contrast how the 1990 prescription was handled as an other acts item of evidence, and how the 5 uncharged prescriptions were handled.
Just clarify one thing. Mm-hmm. Did the handwriting expert testify that the 3 through 7 here, I can't even get it down to 8, was the same handwriting as the convicted 1990?
I believe he did.
Well, according to the brief, if I read Ms. Mollison's brief, she says not. But did they get a handwriting specimen and say that 3 through 7 were the same as the, or highly possible, or whatever his highly probable was the same as the defendant's?
No, they don't. And I'll take back my first answer about the 1990 prescription. That was not compared against the others.
And were all these other forgeries, did somebody testify that they were really highly probable the defendant's handwriting?
No, the most that was said was that the state's document examiner, Detective Urbach, said that when he looked at the exemplars of the defendant's writing, that they gave me new evidence to believe that these prescriptions were written by the defendant. But then when it came down to the point where he had to say to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, he couldn't say it.
So other than the fingerprint on the Sanders one, which is just number 3, matching the defendant's, is that right?
Yeah, there are fingers.
That's the only one that you got moving that shows that he's the culprit?
There are fingerprints on Sanders and Johnson,
right.
And he came in for the Mays one, Exhibit 8.
Right.
So he's clearly connected to those 3. And then
two got out, that one ultimately got out, right?
Pardon?
And number two, the charge on number two has been dropped, right? So
it's the one, yeah.
The Johnson. Okay, I just wanted to know how they tied them in with this. And
yeah, we don't know how the prosecutor tied them in.
If I can follow up on the chief's question, the forgeries in Exhibits 3 through 8, I thought I asked Ms. Mullinson this question, and maybe she didn't understand me, or maybe I didn't understand myself. Was there testimony that whoever did the forgery did all of them, that it was done by
yes.
the same person?
Yes.
Okay. So they were tied up that way.
Right.
Yeah, but not tied to the defendant.
But not tied to the defendant.
Correct.
But Exhibit 3 was tied to the defendant because it had a fingerprint on it.
Yes. And Detective Burbach testified that 1 through 8 were written by the same person.
And now conceivably, since count 2 has been thrown out, and at a new trial, Exhibit 2 might now come in as other crimes evidence to prove count 1, which has his fingerprint on it, was cashed at the same pharmacy, had the same hydrocodone, and was within the same 30-day period.
Do you mean Exhibit 3 rather than Exhibit 2?
No, I mean Exhibit 1 now.
He's talking about the exhibit that relates to charge 2. So
right.
That's Exhibit 1.
Okay. If this goes back for trial, at least I would assume you would argue that now Exhibit 1 has the same weight as Exhibits
yes.
2 and 4 through 7. And in fact, maybe even ties it up even better because it's got a fingerprint.
It has a fingerprint on it, so it's not the same. It's better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could I ask, do you know why Exhibit 1, which is the basis for Charge 2, was not proved to be a forgery?
I think what happened is the prosecutor forgot to call the doctor. He called the doctors as to the others, whose names were signed to the others, but he didn't call Dr. Kratz. So when the court went back and looked at it, there was a hole in the statement.
And on Exhibit 11, what exactly was that? It relates to the 1990 conviction, but what actually is Exhibit 11?
It's a prescription, I believe, for Tussin liquid.
Did the there was no comparison between the handwriting on prescription 11 and the other exhibits. Is that just an oversight, or I mean, you would tell us if there was different handwriting.
Pardon?
I assume you'd tell us if there was different handwriting.
Yes, I need to double check. Exactly how that fit in, because I'm not sure I'm giving you the straight facts of it. What I'm looking for in my brief is the portion where I'm describing Detective Urbach's testimony, because I think that would give the exact details of what he tied together. And I'm looking at pages 31 and 32. Okay, I just can't put my finger on it right now. I'm sorry.
You're done.
The contract.
Okay,
you're going to get to what you want to say in a moment.
Still trying to get this down a little bit here now.
Okay.
Okay, so we didn't. The reason that Exhibits 1 and 2 were not identified as forgeries as such was because Dr. Kratz was not called to say that this was not his writing.
Correct.
But when the handwriting examiner who testified that the same person forged Exhibits 3 through 8, did he state that the writing on 1 and 2 were also done by the same person?
Yes, he did.
So those were tied in that way.
Yes. He examined them all as a group.
Okay, and what about Exhibit 11, which went back to the 1990 conviction? Was that prescription the same, the person who wrote that prescription, was that the same one who forged Exhibits 1 through 8? Or don't we know that?
I believe it was, and I'm not able to cite you chapter and verse on that.
Okay.
Well, you said that in two different ways now, Ms. Bowman. That's the question I asked you.
Yeah, it is.
And we don't have to debate it because that's going to be in the record.
Pardon?
That will be in the record, so let's not worry.
Yeah,
about
and
that.
I'd be happy to file a letter afterwards when I know I can find it.
Okay, that's fine. But we have 1 through 8 tied up with the same person, but not that that same person was the defendant to a reasonable degree of
scientific certainty.
Okay.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know what Tussin liquid is?
No, I looked all through the record for that, and I would ask the court to take judicial notice that the base of the word appears to be the Latin word tussis, which is cough, and I'm suspecting that this is a drug company's clever way of saying end the cough. And the doctors and pharmacists testified that all of these substances are cough suppressants or narcotics, antitussives. So I would make that argument, and that's the most I can make, to say that it's the same thing. The contrast that shows up in the record is the way that the 1990 exhibit was handled as another Axe case. It was raised by motion, which is record item 8. 904-0472 was cited. The state offered it for motive, knowledge, plan, identity, and intent. The defense attorney filed a response, which is item 11 in the record. And responded that the facts weren't all that distinctive, so it's not that probative, and said intent is not an issue in this case, and that it was more prejudicial than probative. Then there was a specific decision on the motion, which appears at volume 36, pages 3-6, and the court admitted it for identity, plan or scheme, motive, and absence of mistake. Noting that the issues were similar, the defendant's conduct was similar, the court found that the drug was the same, and that the time frame is very close, given the fact that the defendant had been in prison part of that time, found that the probative value outweighed the prejudice. And at page 6 of volume 36, the district attorney made a prediction of how the evidence, how the 1990 evidence would come in. He said that it would come in through the police officer and through the document examiner, and would show that the handwriting on the 1990 prescription is identical to the charged prescriptions, and then would also show that there were fingerprints.
Did he show that?
No, he didn't.
He did not. Okay.
He didn't. At volume 39, pages 10 to 11, just before Detective Urbach testified, the 1990 prescription was referenced again with a jury instruction, a curative jury instruction, and again went through motive, opportunity, intent, plan, identity, and absence of mistake. When you look at the jury instruction conference, volume 39, page 71, Judge Kramer's noted that defense counsel had asked for the curative jury instruction, number 275, and said that he would give the instruction again in the formal jury instruction. So it's clear that the defense attorney knew how to handle another X question. But the undefined other acts issue came up in a much more foggy way. The first reference I find is in opening statements, in the district attorney's opening statement, and that's volume 37, pages 18 to 22. And there he said accurately, he predicted accurately what would happen. He said, you'll hear how the police learned of about 7 other prescriptions to the same pharmacy, same substance. The defendant's print was on one and on another. And our examiner will testify that the defendant's prints were on 2 of the F&M prescriptions. and that the same person wrote all seven of the FMM prescriptions plus the Walgreens prescription for the same substance. The next reference we find is volume 37, when pharmacist Hackendall is talking, is testifying at pages 29 to 31, and when he gets as far as saying that he not only found several suspicious prescriptions and pulled them together and called the doctors about them, when the DA asked, did you make a search of your files, defense counsel said, I don't believe the other uncharged acts would be relevant. And at that point, the judge said, does this relate to, and the district attorney said, it does.
Relate to what?
That's the question when you read it. He gets cut off by the answer.
Okay, can I? I'm just going to interrupt you for 1 second. I'm sorry. You know, when I voted to take this case, I thought, and when I read the Court of Appeals decision when I voted to take the case, and when I reread the Court of Appeals decision in preparing for today, I thought this case was going to be an application of Sullivan. Mm-hmm. Where we set forth, or we tried to set forth, I'm not saying we did it or not, we tried to set forth a procedure for how to handle other acts evidence. Now, you've been before this court a long time, right? Mm-hmm. On a lot of cases, and many have been other acts cases, right? Mm-hmm. And that's been a troublesome matter for courts, and not only this court, but courts around the country, right? So Sullivan sets forth not an answer, but a process. And when I read the Court of Appeals decision, it was a question of process. Mm-hmm. Did they attack it right? And, you know, even using the same process, people can disagree. And yet, when I studied the case for oral argument, and when I've been listening to this oral argument, it really has nothing to do with Sullivan. Or very little to do with Sullivan. It seems to me to be another issue. Namely, that the other act's evidence isn't tied enough to the defendant, which is not the usual Sullivan issue.
Right, precisely.
So am I wrong in what I think the case is about? Because, you see, I have trouble hearing a case when I'm this way, and the case is being presented this way. Do you know what I mean?
You're saying we're on different tracks?
Yeah, I'm saying I'm on a different track, and I'm trying to get on the right track, and when I question the defendant counsel, and I was trying to move her onto my track, she wasn't going, and that was her prerogative, and rightfully so. And I'm asking you what the state's track is. I mean, I think the defense track is, she can correct me, the defense track is, regardless of Sullivan, regardless of whether it's a plan, intent, knowledge, regardless of whether it's prejudicial, etc., although that's all preserved, regardless of that, hey, you got all this evidence, and it's good evidence as to Z, but you haven't ever said Z equals gray. I mean, that is, as I understand her argument.
Yes.
Which the Court of Appeals never said anything about.
Right.
Right? Did I miss it there? No.
No, okay. I don't think so.
All right. So what is this? What are you going to argue? Are you going to argue on her track?
Waiver.
Well, I understand. I understood that. We're off waiver because, as you very well know, it's rare that the court rules on waiver. We didn't come here to ordinarily. That's not to say that this case is not a perfect waiver case, right?
Okay. Right.
We're not to say that. Aside from waiver, which I understood perfectly, which track are we going to be on? Are we going to be on Sullivan, or are we going to be on the track of tying this up? Just so I know how to listen to you.
I'd say we're on the Huddleston-Schindler track.
Which is when
there's a fact that, or when there's evidence that's admitted subject to tying it up, it's admitted conditionally.
Okay.
What happens at the point where...
when it's not tied up.
Right, where it supposedly isn't tied up, what procedure do we follow?
So you're on the same track as her, in this, as defense counsel, in the sense that this is tying up to the defendant. There may be other issues, but that's it. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm not going to listen to you. I mean, I can hear you and understand you, I think.
Okay. I was talking about the first objection that came up at trial, and as soon as...
After what?
Pardon?
You up to what?
The first objection to the five uncharged acts, the undefined, unarticulated other acts of offense. And after the district attorney, when the judge said, does this relate to, and he said, it does, the district attorney also said, this will really tie in closer to the document examiner as to writing and fingerprints. And at that point, they went off the record for a sidebar. There was another sidebar at page 31 of volume 37, and there was another sidebar at page 33 of volume 37. And finally, at page 35, as testimony started to come in about exhibits 2 and 4 through 7 at that point, defense counsel said, renew my objection, and the judge said, same ruling. There was no objection when Officer James Plank testified at page 54. And as we've noted before, Judge Kramers did summarize the sidebar rulings at page 59 of volume 37. There is a witty discussion in volume 38 at pages 83 to 90, but I did not find it real enlightening. At that point, I think what was happening was that defense counsel was objecting to the state putting on an unannounced witness, Detective Sandholm, who made the arrest in 1990.
In Witte, they had young girls identify him from the past with the bunny.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
with the
so
rabbit.
They tied him up on that for the identification, if I remember.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. And at page 84 of volume 38, the district attorney, talking about the 1990 prescription, said that the document examiner will compare the 1990 prescription to the current prescriptions, presumably meaning the charged ones or the uncharged ones or all of them. End of that exchange. At volume 39, page 42, that's the end of the state's case. And at that point, defense counsel didn't make a motion to strike. That was the end of Detective Urbach's testimony. There was no motion to strike, no motion to dismiss on grounds of insufficient evidence, nothing whatsoever to clue the court into the idea that Urbach had not made that connection. And then there was the jury instruction conference where defense counsel, and that's at 39, pages 66 to 74, defense counsel objects to the 1990 prescription, but only on the grounds that it's not self-authenticating and that there wasn't sufficient foundation for it, and that's at page 68 of volume 39. He also then objects to exhibits 2, 4, and 5 through 7, just as not relevant. The district attorney's closing is printed in the appendix to the state's brief. And at that point, and you can draw your conclusions from it as much as I can argue them, I would point out that he says to the jury at that point, I gave you the other, that is the uncharged prescriptions, because it's important that the names and the writing are the same on those prescriptions. But he also emphasizes the similarity of the 1990 Act and basically says, the defendant got caught before on this with the same story, basically, so he's not innocent about this. I do have, assuming that we do go beyond waiver, and we evaluate we look at what evaluation the court should have made at the point where the objection should have been made, I think I should make a correction to my brief. At pages 25 and 26, I quoted Schindler and Huddleston for the proposition that when the court is evaluating whether there's enough evidence for a jury to find by a preponderance of the evidence that the fact has been adequately connected, I said that, I quoted the part that says you consider all the evidence. So then in my brief, I went on and considered all the evidence from the trial. I think, in fact, the only thing that makes sense is that when you do that evaluation, you consider all the evidence up to the point at which the objection should have been made. So what you would delete from my brief, from my analysis there, is on pages 25 and 26, paragraphs 7 through 10, where I talk about what Mr. Gray testified to at the trial. And on page 26, the first sentence in paragraph 11 talks about the defendant's testimony, but then the second sentence is acceptable because it's the police officer's account of what was said. And I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman. Ms. Mollison?
I wanted to just briefly respond to something that the Assistant Attorney General stated. She said that she thought that Exhibit 11, which was the prior conviction, had in fact been compared with Exhibits 1 through 8. And I have before me a copy of the first post-conviction motion that the first appellate attorney on this case filed. It's volume 24. And on page 130, the document examiner concludes in a letter dated January 18, 1995, under type of examination requested, whether one person wrote prescriptions Q1 through Q8, that was all he was asked to examine. So he was not asked to examine anything regarding the handwriting on Exhibit 11.
You have that in your brief on page 9 in the second full paragraph. The document examiner failed to compare the handwriting from Exhibit 11, Gray's prior conviction, with the handwriting from Exhibits 1 through 8. You cite records 39:17, records 24:12930. You just cited that last one. And we'll check it.
Yeah, that's just to save the court time. I just wanted to say again, I don't believe the 1990 conviction or the Exhibits 2, 4 through 7 fulfill the statutory exception of preparation of plan. Case law has shown that a plan is supposed to have steps that lead to a common and final goal. And these acts, whoever it is that was involved with these forgeries, appear to be separate acts and not being done towards some common goal. So I do not think that the 1990 conviction or Exhibits 2 and 4 through 7 should be admissible under that exception. If this court does agree with the Assistant Attorney General's analysis that conditional relevance here should control and that the contemporaneous objection rule should swing into play, I urge this court to consider the exceptions to waiver because of the clear confusion that occurred in this case. We know that the jury convicted on insufficient evidence for count 2. And the jury heard all of this evidence presented together in a large Gordian knot. And we cannot be sure what improper inferences the jury may have made in reaching its decision to convict on count 1. I've mentioned in my brief a false syllogism that I was afraid that the state had supported in its opening and closing arguments. I think this is on page 16 of my brief in chief. The same person wrote the prescriptions appearing in Exhibits 1 through 8. All the prescriptions were forged. Some of the prescriptions the defendant handled, therefore the defendant must have written or presented all of them. And I mentioned what the flaws with that are, starting with the fact that they didn't prove everything was forged. Although apparently one person, there's a high probability they wrote part of the prescriptions in Exhibits 1 through 8, it's just the printed portion and not the written signature. Some of the prescriptions the defendant did admit to handling, but it doesn't follow that he therefore must have written or presented all of them. and the state did make that representation several times during its closing arguments.
Well, could the state have presented all this and said, you know, this is all so similar. We don't have him tied up with all of them. We have him tied up with some of them. And if you believe he's tied up with all of them, then you can consider this for knowledge.
You're saying that the state could have made that argument about not tying them up?
Yeah. I mean, that's your objection here, that they're not tied up to the defendant, therefore you can't
prove it.
So suppose the state said, hey, look, we got all of this. I mean, there's a short time period here, right? 594 to 994, right? On all of these. Short time period, same substance, same pharmacy. Same forgery. I mean, I'll give you that they didn't show one and two. And it's sure, and he's handled the stuff. So maybe we don't have it tied up beyond a reasonable doubt, but it sure smells like the defendant here. And if you believe it was the defendant, then you can use all of this evidence for knowledge. But if you don't believe it's the defendant, you don't have to use all of this evidence to show knowledge or intent or plan or motive or whatever. Good enough? Desire?
I'm disturbed by it. I know case law says preponderance is enough. The jury does have to conclude that the defendant committed the acts. They can use a preponderance standard. I think there has to be a connection.
Better than this. You don't think it's a preponderance here?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
You don't think there's a preponderance of evidence here showing a connection?
No, I don't.
Okay. So, could have been done if there was a preponderance. But the judge didn't say that either. I mean, the judge didn't say what I just said, the words to that effect, did he?
I think that's right. He didn't. Yeah. All right.
One question.
Sorry.
Exhibits 1 and 2 were not proved to be forgeries.
That is correct.
But they are forgeries unless